from 90.5 WESA. This is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. And this is so important to me.
Hillary Clinton led in the polls throughout the campaign, but in the end, Donald Trump captured Pennsylvania and the presidency. Why did Pennsylvania go Republican at the top of the ticket for the first time in 28 years? But it wasn't a clean sweep for Republicans in the Commonwealth, as Democrats won all three state row offices. We'll discuss that and the impact of Pittsburgh losing its police chief.
As I look back on the rest of my professional life, I'm full certain that my proudest moments will be serving as the chief of the Pittsburgh Police.
What does this mean for efforts to improve police-community relations? That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. Welcome to The Confluence, where the news comes together. Our weekly news roundup, I'm Kevin Gavin. For the first time in 28 years, Pennsylvania has voted Republican in a presidential contest, and just as in 1988, helped the GOP nominee to the presidency. The Republican incumbent held on to his Senate seat, and the GOP strengthened its hold on the legislature. Also, Cameron McClay has departed after a little more than 2 years as police chief of Pittsburgh. What's the impact? That's all coming up. But we start today's program with the Pennsylvania and the presidency. The Commonwealth goes from blue to red at the top. Donald Trump beats Hillary Clinton by 68,000 votes to win Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes on his way to victory. Joining us to discuss what happened in Pennsylvania Tuesday, Chris Potter, reporter from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back, Chris.
Good to be here.
And Mike Wershagen, freelance reporter who covered both the presidential and Senate campaigns in Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us at WESA Confluence.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. Have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
So, gentlemen, let's start off with, are the pollsters saying in unison, whoops?
At their most polite, they're probably saying whoops. This was so far off from what we've seen in the past. I mean, we've had polls be wrong before.
Sure.
I don't think I have ever seen a disparity this large.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we should there's a lot of cause for humility here in the press and in the pollster community. I think it's worth pointing out, because we're probably going to end up talking about polls and results in a minute here, too. It's worth noting that Hillary Clinton did indeed appear to win the popular vote here.
Right.
So we should just say that this is a race that's, you know, was in with a margin of error of some of the more responsible polls, at least on the national scale. But it is absolutely I think what it comes down to is, pollsters fail to recognize, because what they're doing is they're looking for likely voters. And Donald Trump, the secret sauce, the key to his success, was he turned out a lot of voters that would not pass a likely voter screen because they had not voted in recent elections. And you can see that throughout Pennsylvania, a lot of counties he did very well in. It just seems very clear to me that a lot of people turned out to vote for Donald Trump who had not voted in previous elections. And because of that, they would not show up. A lot of pollsters just would not consider them likely voters when they did their screens.
Part of his pitch.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that was part of what he said. I should win this primary because I'm going to bring people out who don't come out, who have never come out. I'm going to change the electoral map.
Yeah, when we look at those polls, we tend to focus in, whether it's Pennsylvania, North Carolina, another battleground state, et cetera, et cetera. We tend to look and focus on likely voters, but I think, Chris, you're right that the unlikely voters or the not regular voters came out in, I guess, droves.
I had a conversation with the pollster for Monmouth University, which is a very good poll. This guy's a very smart guy. And we talked about this. And he said, look, the polls where Donald Trump does well in or does better in are the polls that really take into account voter enthusiasm. my poll, and he showed Clinton winning Pennsylvania by 6 points. And this was like the weekend before, maybe a week before the election. My poll doesn't do that. I look at traditional standards for have you voted before? Have you done all this? Because I am not sure that when push comes to shove on election day, these folks will turn out. I had this conversation with him, and within a day or two of being stuck in traffic, going out to the Moon Township, where I moved about 100 feet in half an hour on Business 376. Those people, 10,000 of them in that ballpark, went out there, waited 4 hours to hear Donald Trump speak. They heard him speak for 20 minutes, and who knows how long it took him to get back home. There was no question in my mind that a lot of people, that enthusiasm there was going to be there. There was a lot of people who were going to be turning out on election day, even if the best practices of pollsters didn't show that.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much done making snarky comments about yard signs.
Yeah.
It shows enthusiasm, and we saw that enthusiasm on Election Day.
I mean, I want to say this, though. I mean, if you look at Hillary Clinton didn't do that badly amongst the voters she thought she had to turn out. Allegheny County may be the only place in Pennsylvania where she actually improved upon Barack Obama's margins in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, I think the margin in Allegheny County was like
105,000.
Yeah, it was more than 100. Yeah. And his was in the 80s.
It was just 90. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And if you, the old, I wanted to get to this, so let's jump right into it, is the old strategy, and maybe now it's the blown up strategy for Democrats, win big in Philly, win pretty big in Allegheny County, win some suburban Philly counties, and so on and so forth. And Hillary Clinton came out of Allegheny and Philadelphia counties with a larger margin, I believe it was 7,000 voters, than Barack Obama did in 2012, yet she lost. What does that say about the strategy?
Well, I think that
it wasn't good.
Right. What we were talking about before, this enthusiasm, these people who didn't show up to vote before. I mean, people have talked a lot about Erie flipping. Yeah. They've talked a lot about Northampton County flipping. But, you know, you look at the vote totals by county, he came out of Franklin County with 6,000 more votes than Mitt Romney did. He came out of Juniata County with 1,500. You start adding this stuff up county by county, and it swamped the advantages that Hillary Clinton had in Philly and in Allegheny County. It just absolutely overwhelmed it.
Yeah, you chip away, you chip away, you chip away, and when you win 56 out of the 67 counties, if you're chipping away, you have definitely erased that deficit.
Yeah, 1,000 votes here, 1,000 votes there eventually starts adding up to real numbers, I guess.
And I think, actually, she might not have done quite as well in Philadelphia as Obama did. I think she might have been off a little bit. Mike, maybe
I believe it was 10,000.
Yeah.
But still.
Yeah, I mean,
we were hearing if she came out with 350,000 that she would have been satisfied.
It's because they never really fully anticipated this thing coming out of places like Washington County or Fayette County, or just to kind of speak in our area here. I think everybody knew that Donald Trump was going to win Washington County. I don't think they knew he was going to come out of there with twice as many votes as Romney had in 2012. And that was just the difference. And when you think about it, I mean, it is incredible. And people who are, you know, and I suspect your audience is in this category, think about the scope of what these folks did, whether you agree with Donald Trump or his followers or not. Think about the scope of what they accomplished. Hillary Clinton outspent Donald Trump in Pennsylvania media markets by margins of 2 or 3 to 1. She had help from unions. She had help from allied philosophical groups, environmentalists, the Planned Parenthood, all of those folks. And still, his supporters came out and they beat back that entire apparatus. And that is impressive. And I think there's something for, as Democrats kind of lick their wounds and figure out and kind of bind them up and try to figure out how to move forward, there is much to be learned from that, because that is impressive.
Yeah, the night before the election, when she was in Philadelphia with former President Clinton, with Barack Obama, with Michelle Obama, she got up to deliver that speech at a podium that had the seal of the President of the United States. That was the visual going into Election Day that she was able to pull off, which is incalculable in a lot of ways. I mean, you see that, and it just reinforces this idea that this person is of, you know, presidential timber. Didn't matter. Yeah. It didn't matter. The vote totals out of Philly were a bit down. She pulled 26,000 votes fewer votes than Barack Obama did, and Donald Trump actually came out with 9,000 more than Romney did.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was these other counties that really did it. Westmoreland County, 12,500 more votes for Trump than Romney. York County, 13,000 more votes. You just that's really tough to make up. If you do that statewide, that is really tough to make up in a handful of counties, even if they are populous.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. We're talking about the presidential race in Pennsylvania with Mike Wershagen, freelance reporter, and with Chris Potter, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So we used to talk about the old T formation in Pennsylvania, but now with just, if you look at a red-blue map of Pennsylvania in terms of registration, or actually how they voted on Tuesday, you got just a few, well, a handful of pockets here and there of blue. Yes, they are big pockets, Pittsburgh or Allegheny County, Philadelphia, but there's so much red in this state. That's, so the demographics, the geographic, they've changed.
Yeah. I mean, and I'll say about that, Donald Trump did a really shrewd job of exploiting that. I mean, if people can remember the first visit he made to the region, he came to Pittsburgh. He said, I'm bringing back steel, I'm bringing back coal. And people in Pittsburgh were like, why would you want to do that? We just spent 30 years trying to get that in our rearview mirror. But for all the talk about Pittsburgh's resurgence by Democrats locally and by the national press over the years, that stuff didn't get out. That prosperity did not spread out into those sort of outlying areas, the Mon Valley towns, the Allegheny Valley towns, the Ohio Valley towns, and that's where he did best. And I'll tell you, I had an experience in Jamestown Johnstown, right, when Donald Trump came out there, and I talked to a supporter of his. She kind of sought me out, and she went on this kind of thing about how, well, you know, Barack Obama had engineered the overthrow of these dictators in the Middle East to empower the Muslim Brotherhood, and he wants to make the United States part of the caliphate as well, and that's what Black Lives Matter is about, and da 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 da. And, you know, thank you for sharing your viewpoints with me, ma'am. And then she said to me, you know, I used to be an alcoholic before 9/11, and then I realized I was part of the problem. And so I stopped drinking, and I've spent all of my time trying to study the threat of radical Islam. And you can argue, and many would, and that if that's her life story, what she kind of did is exchange a kind of personal pathology with a social one, you know, alcoholism for Islamophobia. But on the other hand, I think it speaks to what's going on there, which is there are communities out there that are hurting very badly, and Democrats, unfortunately, have not really offered a prescription to those communities. And Donald Trump has come along and he has done that. And I think the fear a lot of people have is so much of the energy for that campaign is not healthy energy. And I think there are very real reasons to be concerned about that. But again, we've seen this historically time after time. If you don't provide people some grounds for hope within their lives, within their communities, they will turn to answers that you may not find particularly healthy or palatable or in keeping with our ideas for a pluralistic society. And I'm afraid that there's good reason to think that we may be on the precipice of something like that happening if we don't kind of wrap our heads around it fast.
Yeah, and that idea of not speaking to those voters for the Democrats, I mean, that is a huge part of what happened here.
Yeah.
They're just you brought up the tea before. Well, Allegheny County is not part of the blue block that made it look like a T. Allegheny County is an island.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And Allegheny County has the most registered Republicans of any county in the state.
Right? Yeah. Interestingly, I will say this. Interestingly, if you look, I mean, part of one of the reasons why maybe Trump didn't do quite as well as Romney did in Allegheny County, why, like, I grew up in Upper St. Clair, and I always get curious, kind of how do those folks vote? And it's interesting. Trump underperformed Romney in a lot of places in Upper St. Clair. I think there was a precinct or two where Hillary Clinton in Upper St. Clair actually won. Those are unofficial totals. It could be said it was pretty close, so it could be subject to change. But there was some concern about Trump. The theory that college-educated voters would be turned off by some of his rhetoric, that wasn't entirely untrue in some cases. The problem, I think, is that the Clinton campaign drastically overestimated the participation by college-educated voters and the way in which they would vote. There were a lot of college-educated voters who still went for Donald Trump. And I think part of the Clinton campaign's problem is they went with this sort of identity politics approach. So much of their campaign, think about the ads that you saw. So much of the campaign of the Hillary Clinton campaign ended up being, get a load of what this guy said. I mean, obviously, that wasn't enough. You got to give people something to vote for. And I think that was true on the McGuinty side as well, if we're going to talk about that Senate race.
Well, that's a perfect transition into that. In our remaining few minutes, I do want to talk about the other top race at the height of the ballot. And let's face it, voters did not elect the first woman to the U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania. Toomey held off a strong challenge from Katie McGinty to win a second term, the most expensive Senate race in the country. Last figure I saw was right around $140 million. This was within the margin of error of just about every poll that I saw. So this should not be a surprise, should it, that Toomey won?
No, certainly not in the same election that Donald Trump won. The top of the ticket, you know, is going to help if your nominee wins. That's going to push your numbers up because it means more of your voters are coming out to vote. And like you said, I mean, McGinty had some structural advantages going into this. She has a 900,000 voter registration advantage. Didn't make a difference, but that is, and she had a nominee who seemed to be, or who was leading in every poll coming up to it. So it looked like she had, like she was within striking distance, if not ahead a little bit. And it just did not turn out that way.
Yeah. And I mean, to get to the point I started making earlier, her campaign too in those latter days just became about, so Pat Toomey, you voting for Trump? You're not voting for Trump? What are you doing about Trump? And I think that was that kind of messaging that certainly they tried other things. They tried to hang this community bank stuff on him, which I'm not really sure how successful that was. But there just didn't feel the sense of like, you know, why am I getting behind this person in a way? And I think too, there's got to be on all levels within the Democratic Party some real consideration about how they set themselves up for this in the primary, especially. I don't think there's any question whatsoever that the DSCC, the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, put its thumb on the scale for Katie McGinty. There's obviously, no news to the cognoscenti that they weren't crazy about Joe Sestak, her leading opponent in the primary. Would Joe Sestak have fared better? We'll never know. Is the road not taken? But he certainly would have been able to pitch himself as an independent candidate to a much greater extent than she would have in an election season where political independence, people were putting a premium on that. So you look at that, you look at some of the concerns raised on the national level about sort of how the DNC, whether they also were kind of tipping the scale a little bit toward away from Bernie Sanders. There need to be some very serious questions about how this party is going to go forward in terms of how it allows its own voters to get behind people. Because what we saw with Hillary Clinton, and this happened in 2008, she tried in 2008, it didn't work, and she tried it again this time, is to portray herself as the candidate of inevitability. Democrats don't like to have these sort of fratricidal primary battles. Well, I hope if 2016 does nothing else, it should convince Democrats that having a spirited, even kind of bruising primary doesn't necessarily hurt you.
Well, and also keep in mind that it's good for us to remember that in the waning days, everybody was looking at the same race that we were looking at. It was Pat Toomey was running ads showing him being praised by Barack Obama.
And as a check on Hillary Clinton's presidency.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. 1 minute remaining, gentlemen. So is Pennsylvania a red state, a purple state, a blue state with an aberration as in 1988 when it went for George H.W. Bush? What color state are we?
I think you got to say purple. And I think if you're Democrats, you should be looking fearfully at 2018. You've got Bob Casey running for reelection as senator, and you've got Tom Wolf, who I got to say ain't exactly sitting pretty right now. And he will be facing what is going to be a very strong challenge from State Senator Scott Wagner from York County. And that is something serious. Scott Wagner, you'll probably hear it later in your broadcast, support a lot of very successful Republican candidates to run for state Senate. He's been very successful. He needs to be taken seriously.
Mike?
Yeah, get used to seeing a lot more political ads because this state just became winnable by both sides.
Alrighty, gentlemen, thank you so much. Mike Wershagen is a freelance reporter covering politics. Chris Potter is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, gentlemen. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, Cameron McClay urges his commanders and rank and file to stay the course as he resigns after just 2 years on the job. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up a little later, more on the elections. The Democrats sweep the statewide row offices while the Republicans strengthen their grip on the legislature. But first, Cameron McClay has resigned as chief of police of the city of Pittsburgh after just a little more than 2 years on the job. Let's talk about that with Jeff Benzing, reporter for Public Source, focusing on criminal justice and public safety. Welcome back, Jeff. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us in studio is WESA's Virginia Alvino-Young, who reports on police and community issues. Virginia, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. First off, did Cameron McClay ever have a chance with the FOP coming in as an outsider, the first chief that didn't come from within the ranks? You're both smiling. Jeff.
I mean, that's a good question. I don't know if you could say he never had a chance, but it seemed like they turned on him pretty quickly. He came in, September? And then it was in New Year's of that year where he posed with the poster during a celebration saying he vowed to challenge racism at work. And it seemed like that was it's sort of a flashpoint that defined his tenure at that point, that he was someone that was seen as offending the FOP, and publicly we sort of saw that grudge come out, and that's not long into a 2-year term.
There were certainly signs early on. I think anybody would make the case. Chief McClay had made the case. Peduto said many times, you know, change is hard. Change is hard for anybody. But in terms of signs that they were maybe open to those challenges, they were very few.
I mean, to the two, I hate to call it two sides, but it's administration and it's the union, see themselves as adversaries rather than partners in the enhanced public safety for the entire community.
Right. So, I mean, the union's job is to stand up for the rank and file. That's right. Certainly, I think, understandable to right. the public at large. The question is whether or not they're doing that in a way that benefits the community, or if they're doing that as an insular force. And Chief McClay, when he came in, made it very clear early on that he was going to bridge gaps between the Pittsburgh police and the community, which would indicate that that's something that had been lacking for a long time. And if you don't have both sides, meaning the police and the leadership of the police, on the same page there, that's very difficult to do. And it's also very difficult to come together internally like that.
As far as efforts in the community, though, McClay's also said, you know, if there's one thing he didn't have trouble with, it was getting officers to engage more with the community and saying, you know, that's what they wanted to do anyways. And the community, to an extent, would agree, as much as a lot of the community really did back McClay, especially, you know, his overall vision for what he wanted to see. They would say, you know, I've heard many people say that they did have more positive experiences, just more day to day with the rank and file.
In McClay's news conference last Friday, he mentioned that he had told Mayor Peduto that police chiefs on average stay 2 to 3 years. But do we get a sense that that was his intent, to stay 2-3 years in Pittsburgh or not? Or did he give any indication that was his intent all along?
I mean, he said, you know, 3 is not 2, right? So he definitely left at on the early side of that. Nathan Harper was here 6 years, and he got indicted and resigned. You know, so it's not like Pittsburgh itself has a history of having these sort of quick police chiefs. But right before Nathan Harper, Chief Costa was there just a brief period, but you know, that had to do with health issues and change of leadership. You know, he was really sort of a flash in the pan to be someone who is there to reform something that had this history of problems over, you know, more than just a couple of years. I mean, we're talking decades where there's been this tension, and that's not to say there haven't been good things going on all along. Certainly there have, but identified issues that can't be fixed overnight.
And there's plenty of signs that his intent was to stay longer. I mean, very recently, you know, when he said it at the press conference on Friday to reporters, when asked, you know, you just said that you were planning on staying as long as you could, and that was not that long ago. What's changed? And he's saying, well, I knew my time was coming short, and I, you know, didn't want to challenge that idea anymore. I mean, it's clear that him, you know, with the ongoing support of Mayor Peduto, would have liked to not just plant the seeds of this vision, but to actually execute some of those change measures.
His time was coming short. Mm-hmm. So Jeff mentioned one incident that was just 3-4 months after he took over as chief of police. So was it a series of incidents, whether it was that one or speaking at the DNC or apologizing for past injustices between police and African-American community, or what? Or is it just, you know, adding up?
The big one would be the DNC, because of all the actions that led to, multiple investigations, a lot of attention placed on that one incident. But I mean, there were ongoing disputes about scheduling and overtime and all sorts of things. You know, they always seem to have the FOP, that is, some sort of grievance about his leadership and its decisions. But in terms of apologies, I mean, that's sort of the one thing that the community lauded the most, was his ability to apologize. Plenty of people saying, I've never in my life seen any sort of police officer offer any sort of apology. But that's something that definitely was a side in the thorn of the FOP.
We had a police community forum actually right as he took office, and he was apologizing to a young man who had been shot by an officer. Mm-hmm. And that shook up his parents. They didn't expect that. The mother was in tears hearing that. It was different, that's for sure.
I mean, that's what sort of Chief McCoy brought to the table, and what he was sought out to do, is to be that outside, you know, doesn't have the baggage of years and years of being through hard times at the department and hard times with the community relationship. And we have lost that. Whether that's good or bad, you know, there's certainly points on either side. But that force as a catalyst for outside change is now gone. And so I think that's why so many people in the community are worried that what has been different over the little over 2 years that he was here is now going to either taper off or go away more quickly than that.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together, in 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the departure of Cameron McClay as chief of police of Pittsburgh and what this will mean to relations between the police force and the community. At his news conference last week, McClay urged his commanders and the rank and file to stay the course. And at his farewell gathering Monday evening, he had that same message for community members.
You know, moving forward, you know, I beg, please, let's start thinking about our common interests, our common needs, and how we move toward it, rather than looking for ways to blame, trying to figure out what went wrong, trying to figure out, okay, who do I want to be mad at?
It seems that in general, and you both alluded to this, that McClay did help to improve feelings within the community, if not within the rank and file.
There's a lot of fear now. There at that meeting that cut was coming from, it was emotional. It was very emotional. People that did not ever expect to be sad about the departure of a police chief. People like the president of the Association for Police Accountability saying this is the worst thing that could happen for police accountability in the city of Pittsburgh. They were apprehensive at first of McClay coming in. That turned to great respect and hope that change could come, and could come much more quickly than they had ever anticipated. All that's in the air now is fear that those steps will be undone.
He also used the word beg. He's begging people to come together and to find commonalities. That doesn't sound like a word you would use when the job is done and we're all together and we get sort of our common mission. That means that there could be a real chance that doesn't happen. And it seems like it's unclear how we really get there. Who's going to bring it? Is the internal leadership now going to be able to push that forward, or are we going to fall into the same issues we had previously?
Well, he's also saying, you know, hey, community who backed me, my vision is not leaving with my departure, begging people. I mean, it's very much a microcosm of what we're seeing in the country in many ways, saying with this departure, this vision can live on, and it's more important of time than ever to come together to see that through.
Dennis Henderson spoke at McClay's. Well, Henderson, you might recall, was arrested in 2014. This was after he left a meeting about police-community relations, and charges were dropped. ACLU's suit led to a settlement with Pittsburgh police, and he said that McClay changed his long-standing views about relationships with the police.
And to be for real, I came in there very suspect of you, sir.
I get that a lot.
And I listened to his words, and I said he's saying all the right things. And as much as I was trying to resist it, I was feeling a kindred spirit that he was just a good person.
Kindred spirit. So in your reporting, Jeff and Virginia, did you get a sense of that feeling from others within the community when you talked to people, when whether it was at this farewell gathering or elsewhere?
I certainly have talked to community leaders that sort of were very quickly won over by his vision and saw something that was really new and was fitting in with a broader reform movement of police nationwide, where we've seen pretty clearly over the last couple of years that this is not an issue that's just in Pittsburgh, the need to rebuild bridges that have been badly, badly broken. And it seems like people were very quickly on board. And at McClay's farewell, he was saying, you know, we can see our progress because people who were not friends of the Pittsburgh police at the beginning here are now.
I mean, that was the sense at that meeting, right? Everybody just sort of surprised how saddened that they were and how much this meant to them. I mean, what we heard Mr. Henderson talking about was after, you know, his suit was settled, his ACLU suit was settled, talking to Chief McClay, who then apologized for that incident. And I think that was so meaningful, especially to the African-American community, because it meant that they didn't have to plead with anybody to justify their experiences or to make them known that they were valid experiences or true experiences. And a lot of the sentiment that I saw from prominent reverends, prominent community leaders, was that with McClay at the helm, they didn't have to worry that things would get out of control. They were just a little bit, this is what they're saying, is that they were just a little bit more put at ease, feeling like they did have an ally at the top.
I'm curious about events of Wednesday evening, the night after the election, whether this was a sort of a reflection how things might have changed in Pittsburgh, or whether this was just a completely separate event. And I'm talking about the protests of by anti-Trump individuals. So there's a march. It begins about 8:30 in East Liberty. Police follow behind initially. Then they start blocking off the streets. It's looking like it's going to protect people from getting hit by traffic, but also to keep traffic moving. Then police in riot gear show up a little after 9, didn't engage with the protesters. About 9:30, they announced, okay, it's an unlawful protest, unlawful assembly, and they would start making arrests if you didn't disperse. Around 9:45, some smoke goes off. Still really didn't engage. There was some people did run. One cop says, come on, go home. Some protesters yell back to them, go home. But anyway, they decided to go back to the starting point peacefully. A few more speeches and everything dispersed. There was no real negative engagement that I could see. I mean, is this just a separate incident, or is this a reflection of how police might be interacting with the community, or is it a different community? I know there's a lot of questions in there.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's certainly not an event where people were getting their heads knocked or anything. It's not when people sort of say riot gear, that's what they kind of think about. You know, that's not what happened. But there is the issue of how it looks. The reform-minded chief is gone. His last day was the day before.
Right.
And then you have this incident. And whether anyone acted improperly or if this is what would have exactly happened under McClay, you know, I don't really have an analysis there. But within the community, you see smoke thrown, people protesting over, you know, when you say the Trump presidency, that means things in terms of law and order, though. You know, he ran as the law and order candidate. Rudy Giuliani has been floated as the head of a Justice Department. Justice Department's working currently with the Pittsburgh police. And so it's not just a, you know, it's something that's totally disconnected from policing community issues. It's very closely related to that. And it just, it depends, you know, maybe it changed some views, caused some fear, or maybe people are saying, you know, this was an isolated incident. That's kind of hard to say, but it raises questions, certainly.
And it's certainly a delicate time. You know, the community relations are hanging on by a thread. People who were sort of, again, won over by McClay and now fearful of if that vision will continue. And it's obviously a concern that Mayor Peduto expressed when he says, you know, when he later had to apologize for sort of raising his voice at police officers, saying, you know, is this how we want to be interacting, or at least the appearance that we want to give of how we're going to be interacting with incidents like this?
All right. We have 1 minute left, folks. Acting Chief Schubert, we have, he's been basically given 90 days to prove himself. But first of all, do we know, doesn't the city have to post that job? And number two, the broader question is, he's come up through the ranks. It seems like McClay and Peduto are confident he will continue on McClay's. What do we anticipate from Acting Chief Schubert?
I think that's the question. I mean, I know that there are folks internally and folks in the community, as far as community activists and leaders. I mean, they have said he's a decent guy. He's seems to have bought into the new model, the new way in terms of the work he's been doing recently. But he has a long history with the department. He's been through hard years. You know, the union leader says he's a good cop. He's going to wait and see. He's glad there's someone internal.
Yeah, much more predictable of a choice, obviously. Approved, you know, stamp of approval by Chief McClay. Been with the force 24 years, I think, and seems to have at least somewhat of a rapport with some of the community that I've seen interact with him.
All right. WESA's Virginia Alvino Young reports on police and community issues. And Jeff Benzing is a reporter for Public Source, focusing on criminal justice and public safety. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Republicans strengthen their hold on the state legislature, but Democrats capture all three statewide row offices. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. While Republicans in Pennsylvania captured the top two prizes on the ballot, President Donald Trump and the U.S. Senate incumbent Pat Toomey, Democrats won the other three statewide contests, the row offices, Attorney General, Auditor General, and Treasurer. Joining us to talk about that and the GOP solidifying their control of the legislature, Katie Meyer, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and public radio stations across the state. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
And John Misek, opinion page editor for the Harrisburg Patriot News and Penn Live. Welcome back, John. Good to talk with you.
Hey, good to be here.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. First of all, why? Voters, were they giving consolation prizes to the Democrats by voting for the incumbent Auditor General DePasquale, voting for Josh Shapiro as Attorney General, voting for Joe Torsella for Treasurer? So did the Dems get the consolation prizes? We'll start with you, John.
I mean, I guess it's tempting to think that that's the case. I mean, that's the weird thing, Kevin, about these row offices. I mean, you can look at the top of the ballot and see the way things went for Republicans, but when you start breaking things down, these races become very personality specific. They become very localized. They become about name recognition and ballot position and all that kind of stuff. You know, and one of the things about defeating incumbents too is that challengers have to give voters a good reason to toss them, merely aside from matters of party. You know, it's pretty easy to argue that Eugene DePasquale, the incumbent Auditor General had done a pretty good job, and you'd have to come up with a compelling reason to toss him. You know, John Brown may well be known in Northampton County, but not a lot of statewide name ID, so that's a big problem. The open seat in the Treasurer's office, Joe Torsello from Philadelphia, a lot of ties to Ed Rendell, a fairly well-known name in statewide political circles. You can't say the same thing for Otto Voigt. You know, the name of the fight for Attorney General. That one was a little perplexing, but from the outset, it looked like Josh Shapiro had the organization and the money and was going to prevail in that race.
Katie?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I've been following the Attorney General race specifically, Josh Shapiro definitely did have a more, I would say, professionally organized campaign. He had a lot more money. His ground game was fairly strong. With that race, you got into a little bit of, you know, Kathleen Kane, the former Attorney General, who's been in federally convicted of perjury. She was a Democrat, sort of a younger, possibly, you know, looking to go to higher office, which is what Shapiro had been criticized about by John Rafferty. But in the end, I do think his organization was a little better. He got his name out there very well, so he prevailed. And in the other races, I think it was very much the same thing, you know, what kind of campaign these guys ran. But yeah, I mean, you said consolation prize. In a way, it sort of is, because again, these aren't offices where a lot of actual governing happens.
So, how much? Of course, you folks paid attention to these races, but how much attention in general was paid to the races? The lack of awareness, and if there indeed was a lack of awareness, does that favor the Democratic nominees just because of the edge in registered voters?
It certainly could say something about that. I do think that there is certainly less attention paid on these offices, largely because, again, these aren't highly public positions, nor are they highly partisan positions when you get down to it. They are, you know, law enforcement positions in most ways. So, I mean, I think, a registration edge certainly could play into it. Although, I mean, we did get a lot of Republican voters in the state this year, so I think it just comes down to name recognition, among other things.
John?
No, I mean, it's certainly an argument for, you know, the candidates benefiting from the relative obscurity of these offices. Loman Henry, who's a conservative activist from central Pennsylvania, wrote an op-ed for us a little while back, arguing, I thought quite sensibly, that these offices are in fact so important. I mean, the state treasurer writes the checks, the attorney general defends and prosecutes, the auditor general, and as a fiscal watchdog, that these offices are in fact so important that they ought to be moved to the off years when Pennsylvanians elect municipal races and judges for that very reason. They kind of get overlooked, and so as a consequence, that he with the better ground game, and it's been he most of the time, with the exception of Kathleen Kane, generally prevails.
Who knows what would happen
if the field were open, for instance.
Right. So, Katie mentioned Kathleen Kane. It seems as if voters didn't hold it against the Democratic candidates, Josh Shapiro and Joe Torsella, that their elected predecessors in those offices, Kathleen Kane and Rob McCord, have both been convicted. In other words, let's give the other party a chance. So it doesn't look like voters did it that way.
No, it doesn't. I do think those, you know, previous convictions, I mean, we mentioned Kathleen Kane, but just to put it out there, two out of the last three treasurers have been federally prosecuted as well. Those are offices that have been overshadowed by some significant scandals. And that did factor in heavily to the campaigns, but I think ultimately, yeah, people realize that these things aren't maybe so much tethered to party as they are to the type of person who previously held those offices. And both candidates in both of the races really pushed the fact that they would be trying to move the office past its previous issues. So, we didn't see too much, partisan backlash in that way.
Let's move on to the legislature. The GOP extended their margins in both chambers, both the House and Senate. Here's Terry Madonna, political analyst with Franklin and Marshall College.
You've got a situation where the Wolf agenda moving forward for his next 2 years is not going to be in great shape. It's going to require a lot of compromise and a lot of give and take by the governor.
Senate now, the Republicans in the Senate now have a supermajority. Has Tom Wolf's job gotten even more difficult, John?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about that. If Governor Wolf thought he had a hard time getting his proposals through the House and the Senate, he's going to have an even harder time this time around. And as you quite correctly pointed out, he now faces a veto-proof majority in the state Senate. But, I mean, the one thing I would say is that before Republicans start taking a victory lap on this one, they will face their own sets of challenges. As we've seen in the last two budget cycles, it was often hard for Republican leaders in the and Senate to round up the votes they needed on some compromise measures because they ran into resistance from Tea Party conservatives within their own caucus. When you have a much larger caucus to manage, it becomes that much harder to round up the votes. And it's going to be a little bit, I think, if Republicans in the state now think that, well, everything's just going to sail through because they have these huge majorities, the task facing the respective floor leaders in the House and Senate just got a little bit more difficult as well. Add on top of that that you have some personalities in both chambers who are aspiring governors. There's that added bit of friction as well.
Katie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. You can't overlook the fact that there is some significant division within the Republican Party, specifically in the House itself. And I think it's also worth noting that Republicans have been dominant in this state for quite a while now. And we've seen their margin shifting even more this year, but it's following a trend that's been going on for quite a while. I saw an interesting statistic earlier today. Right now, as of Election Day, Democrats in the Southwest have really sort of collapsed. There's only three Democratic senators west of the Susquehanna River right now. So just looking at it geographically, too, sort of shows you the lines at which these people are divided. And, you know, I mean, it's a trend that has been going on for some time.
Yes. For instance, Democratic Senator Sean Wiley of Erie lost. And also the Republicans won a seat held by the retiring John Wozniak, also a Democrat from the Somerset Johnstown area. So the Senate is veto-proof. The House, although it's a large majority, isn't. So does Wolf still have a chance of getting some of his ideas through, or does he have to compromise even more? We have about a minute and a half left, folks.
I mean, I think he's always had to compromise quite a bit. And I will say with the veto-proof majority in the Senate, because the House does not have a veto-proof majority, I mean, it's not really as powerful a thing as it could have been if they also had one, which they don't. You're going to have to see a lot of compromise, I suppose, from the Wolf administration, and it's going to be interesting to see what form that takes.
John?
No, I think Katie has absolutely hit it on the head. The governor has three fewer Democrats than he had in the House last session, which means he has three fewer votes for the programs that he needs, which means he'll probably have to come to the middle on a lot of stuff. We'll find out sometime in the next six months, if Governor Wolf himself plans to run for a second term, and that could color the landscape as well. One might find that he's more inclined to compromise under those circumstances.
John Micek is the opinion page editor for the Harrisburg Patriot News and Penn Live. Katie Meyer is Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and for public radio stations across the Commonwealth. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Finally, today is Veterans Day. About 250,000 veterans live in southwestern Pennsylvania, each with a story of how service impacted them.
I tell everybody that my time in Vietnam at 1 year at that age of 20-something was really 5% of my life at that time. But that experience is 75% of who I am today.
How did serving your country change who you are today?
Oh, my gosh. How didn't it? Some of us are getting killed, so you're dealing with so much, and it made me grow up.
Strongest memory in Mosul in 2003, we opened up a bunch of schools. And I remember sitting in the foyer of the school, getting ready to jump back in the convoy and jump back in my turret, when a little girl came up to me with big old eyes and said the words thank you to me, after presenting them with little backpacks of clothes and books and everything a little kid could ever want for school. I hold on to that memory because, especially now with what's going on in Iraq with the ISIS and everything else going down, you know, it makes me wonder, what's that girl doing today?
That was Ron Warstall, Amanda Haynes, and Ben Keene To hear the voices of many veterans, you can go to WESA.FM and click on Veteran Stories Project 412. Thanks so much to our veterans and to our active duty servicemen and women. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance from Vince Balestrino. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, we hope you have a good week of good news.